Call from mom. Answer it. Call silenced.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Hey everybody, this is Richard Deitch, and welcome to the Sports Media Podcast. My producers are Patrick Antonetti and Sean Cherry. Today's guest is somebody I have just such immense respect for. It's Tom Verducci, Sports Illustrated senior writer, as well as a Fox Sports and MLB Network reporter and broadcaster. I worked for many years with Tom at Sports Illustrated, actually fact-checked some of his stories, which were an absolute pleasure. The guy is essentially the definition of pro. He was an amazing, amazing colleague. And as I've told the story many times, either in print, probably in podcast form too, when I was 19 at the University of Buffalo, I wrote two letters. One was to a local Buffalo News sports columnist. One was to Tom Verducci, basically just asking them to look at my shitty copy and give me any kind of advice. Never heard from the Buffalo News person who lived pretty much in my neighborhood. Heard from Tom Verducci, wrote me a two-page handwritten letter on what I had written and how to get better, and I'm sure I still have that letter somewhere in my mom's house. That's stuff you never forget. And then to join Sports Illustrated and to be on the same masthead as Tom Verducci was just like an absolute thrill. I think the guy's the best baseball writer I've ever read, and I think he's the best baseball writer of his generation for sure. So Tom Verducci will be on this podcast, and we're going to talk about baseball's plans to restart and sort of how Tom sees that possibility. But beyond that, just how baseball media is going to change in this new paradigm and how writers will deal with the limited access, and will that last? How broadcasters will call games without being there, and that's just the very likelihood of that. The prospect of having temperature checks and health officials basically check you every time you enter a major league facility. A lot of interesting things that are going to happen. And then finally, we discussed Tom's piece on Michael Jordan's time with the White Sox in Birmingham and AA. Tom did sort of a retrospective of that, and I just find that fascinating because I think Jordan is totally underrated as a baseball player in terms of just how amazing he did what he did in AA with basically having not played for years and walking into a very, very competitive baseball league. So Tom Verducci of Sports Illustrated, Fox Sports, and MLB Network coming up on the Sports Media Podcast. All right, as I said at the top in the intro, Tom Verducci, one of my longtime colleagues at Sports Illustrated, one of my favorite colleagues, and I sort of gave you his impressive resume at the top of this, and Tom Verducci joins me on the Sports Media Podcast. Tom, thanks for joining me, and I hope you and yours are well.
Everybody's safe, and I hope the same for you. How you doing, Richard?
We're holding up here, and I appreciate that, Tom. So the reason, Tom, I mean, it's always good to have you on, but one of the reasons I wanted to have you on this week is sort of the momentum for Major League Baseball returning in some form sort of continues to grow by the day. So I want to start off with a macro question here, and that is, has there been any format or contingency plan for restarting baseball that strikes you as particularly sound or maybe the most possible that we might see early?
Yeah, actually, and at the risk of tooting my own horn, because from back in March, I had promoted this, or at least suggested this schedule-wise, to cut down on the amount of travel. I suggested just playing games within your division and then playing interleague games against the team in the opposite division, the opposite league. So East plays East and West plays West, Central plays Central. And when you start working out the math, you realize it almost sounds, at least on an East Coast version, of like the 1940s baseball, where guys could take trains, you know, between Boston, New York, Washington, Philadelphia. And that looks like the safest way to come back. Now, there may be some issues. I mean, you're talking about 30 major league teams, so there's going to be different levels of concern about what the risks are in different areas. That's, it's a huge country. Country is plural. So putting that aside, I just think the idea of having teams not travel as much as they shouldn't, I think that's a good place to start. And it also, to me, keeps the divisions, the importance of the divisions in place. So you're not going to back into winning your division by beating up teams in another division. It's almost like an American Legion tournament. You know, you really got to win all those head-to-head games against teams in your division. You have a true division champion.
Tom, have you, you know, one of the things that I found really interesting is sort of watching the Korean Baseball League, watching if you're, let's say, a fan of soccer, sort of how the Bundesliga is going to try to start up. Sticking to baseball, have you watched that league, not necessarily for the baseball, Tom, but to sort of see how it's working for them? You know, no crowds, how the players are reacting to playing with no crowds. And then if you're just reading about that league, you know, the kind of temperature testing and checks that they're doing.
Yes. And there's a lot we can take from the KBO, and there's a lot we can't. For instance, there's only 10 teams there. We have 30. The greatest distance between teams in that league is a 50-minute plane ride. So the scale in this country is much larger than what it is in the KBO. And also, there's no question that because they did a better job in terms of testing and contact tracing to begin with when the virus hit, they don't have nearly the amount of infections and deaths created by the coronavirus and COVID-19 that we have here. So, you know, I caution that it's not a direct comparison, but some of the protocols, I think, do pave a path for MLB to return, such as you mentioned, the testing that's in place, the body scan, temperature imagery that, you know, everybody can go through before they walk on a field, keeping the clubhouse as sanitary and as limited as possible, only players and staff in there, you know, no media, no front office people. Creating this sort of bubble is what they call it, and how to do that from a protocol standpoint, I think, is definitely something that Major League Baseball can and has taken from. They've been in contact with that league, with the Bundesliga you mentioned. So yes, I think in baseball's case, they don't have to start from a square one and wonder how some of these things might work. It's being done in practice as we speak.
All right, Tom, I want to shift to sort of covering the game and what might be a new normal. So again, sort of an overview question. If baseball returns in whatever sort of contingency plan that they do, how do you think, let's forget about the broadcast part of it for a second, because I do want to ask you about that, because obviously people know you work for MLB Network and Fox, but how do you think baseball will be covered in sort of a new paradigm if reporters will not have, and clearly will not have, access to the clubhouse before the game, after the game? How will this change the sport with a significant reduction in access?
Yeah, to be honest with you, Richard, I'm a little bit worried about that, because this is something that the union has pushed for in the past in terms of limiting the access. They brought up the idea of Olympic style access, where you just have that room where they bring people in that you ask for. It's a very stilted environment. I am of the opinion, not because I'm biased, because, you know, access to me and what I do is great, but I think as a fan of the game as well, access is super important. It's how you introduce the people who play the game to the fans, and not just the game itself. I've been a little bit worried, I got to be honest with you, the last couple of years that baseball players have become commodities in the consumer world. And I say that because sometimes, you know, the people who run these major league teams talk about players according to whether a 2-WAR player, a 3-WAR player, or what their salary is, what their free agent value is. I mean, it's like almost like following, you know, financial world, in the business world, that it's a stock market. And I think we've gotten away from who are these guys? What are their stories? How are they aspirational, not just inspirational? And I think the more we limit access to players to let them tell their stories and have their personalities be known and seen, then the more they become numbers and less like people. And I think one of the great things about baseball has been traditionally better access than a lot of sports. and you get to know these players. So I'm a little bit worried about that. Again, as a fan of the game, not so much. Well, it definitely is part as a journalist, but even as a fan of the game. And if I were not a journalist and I were a fan, yeah, I want to know as much as I can about these guys and feel like I know them. I'm rooting for people that I can identify with. So I don't think it's – listen, I understand these are very uncertain times we've never been through before, and I understand the need for it in the short term, but I don't want to see it become the quote-unquote new normal that this is, okay, we're going to use this opportunity now to really limit access.
Tom, have you seen any of the photos from the KBO of the reporters sort of holding these mics where they're, you know, 6 feet away, 10 feet away from the players? So the players may be in like sort of one part of the stands. The journalists are a couple rows up and are interviewing those players with a distance. I found sort of the social distancing of the media pretty interesting there. And if you've seen those photos, I wanted to get your impression of what you thought that was.
Yeah, well, listen, there was something similar that happened right before baseball shut down in spring training. If you were in spring training camps, you know, the clubhouse became off limits. And then if you wanted a player, you did have to stand 6 feet away from that player to do an interview. Again, these are times that really call for extreme measures, and safety and of the health of everybody involved is paramount. So I wouldn't argue in this environment that, you know, we should be sitting right next to somebody at their locker talking one-on-one. But again, I wouldn't want to see that become just, okay, it worked, so let's continue to do that even in quote-unquote normal times.
Let me ask you about the broadcast then, Tom, because this will certainly impact you. What do you think about the prospect of calling games from a monitor, calling games from, I'm just going to sort of make this up randomly, the Fox Sports studio in New York City?
Yeah, listen, if it has to be done, you do it. And I still think, like anything else, you'll do it to the best of your ability. But there's no question that you would lose something by not being there. I mean, when I do a game in the booth, I don't watch the monitor a lot. There are things I see outside the vision of the camera shot that really informs the way I do a game. And, you know, there's no question that it's limiting if you're just limited to that particular shot. Now, it may be necessary, but hopefully there's a way that, you know, the people who are actually bringing the games into the homes of these fans are there as well. If you can't have fans at the game, you want as much of the feel of the game as possible. And I think the fact that there will be no fans there is a huge challenge. And fans are such a big part of the game. And I think if we have baseball without fans, you'll really realize it. I mean, I understand we know that now, and the players say that a lot. And it's true that the fans really provide the adrenaline, the atmosphere. They're so important to Major League Baseball. Without them, you will really understand that. I mean, it'll seem like instructional league games in Florida in the middle of the day in 90-degree heat. The sound of the game will sound extremely different. So I think it's more important than ever to have as much feel from the actual venue to deliver to the people at home and not have it be so antiseptic. So again, you know, if it has to be that way, where you can't be there, I get it. But I'd love to think that there is a way to be there.
All right, following up on that, let me read you something that I saw that the Bundesliga broadcast personnel, not necessarily on-air talent, but including on-air talent and production people, they have to get body temperature checks walking into the stadium. They have to answer 8 questions about their health. You know, things like, do you have a fever, cough, sore throat? Where have you been in the last 14 days? There's a hygiene officer that determines basically if you will be allowed to enter the facility or not. As somebody who in real terms, Tom, may have to enter stadiums in some kind of capacity, how would you feel about just sort of undergoing these kind of questions and tests to cover baseball?
Sign me up. I mean, I have no problem with that. Again, you're creating a bubble here that has to be held to the strictest, highest standards available. So from what I understand, the Bundesliga is limiting the actual number of people in the stadium, media, players, staff, et cetera. I think the number is 300. So as long as you can do as much as you can to provide for the safety and assurances of those 300 people, Yeah, I'd be more than willing to sign up for that. I mean, it's like getting on an airplane now. You know, the protocols are a lot different than it was, you know, 20, 25 years ago. But we all do it because we know it's for our own good. And I would feel the same way going to, a ballpark with really strict protocols. I wouldn't want to see anything less.
I want to ask you a couple sort of general questions about baseball and the media today. I think one of the things, Tom, and you were one of the forerunners here, was if there was sort of a, maybe 2.0 is a little too cliche, 2.0 of baseball writing, maybe it was like 7.0, but analytics and sort of the use of numbers in baseball writing has been one of the most prominent changes in how the content of that sport has been consumed in the last 10, 15 years. Do you have any thoughts, Tom, as to what you think the next sort of iteration of baseball writing will be? I saw some people sort of hypothesize that maybe gambling content becomes sort of the next wave of baseball writing and that you incorporate that. I don't know if that's going to be the case or not, but anything sort of come to mind as to what the next evolution of baseball writing is? And I think both of us hope that the next evolution is that there's not less of it. There's still more of it.
Yeah. No, I see continued specialization. I mean, we're seeing that throughout our society now where, you know, if you get into the medical field, you start drilling down to the really specific areas that the general practitioner, the country doctor, so to speak, and I'm sure they're still out there, but not in numbers that they were. It's the same with people covering sports in general. I mean, when I started, the sports columnist, the generalist, was the star of the show, right? The Dick Youngs, the Mike Lupicas of the world. And now people want expertise. And so I see, you mentioned analytics. It's certainly something that, that wave has really become strong and deep. But I also see, you mentioned gambling. I think for sure that there will be a segment. I'm not saying it will drive sports baseball coverage, but it's certainly a segment devoted to gambling information. And I even think things like injury prevention and, you know, the way the body works, kinesiology. I mean, you talk to hitting coaches and pitching coaches now, and they're like experts in how the body works, the muscles, the training, the kinesiology. So you're going to need writers who understand that and not just understand it superficially. Same with analytics. If you try to come at analytics in a very superficial way, you know, people are not going to buy what you're saying. People want true expertise. So I think you're going to see I don't want to say silos because you still have to understand the game. But the areas of expertise, I think, will be even more defined going forward. I still think, though, and maybe I'm super old school in this regard, Richard, that what people have always wanted, and as platforms change, as the game changes itself, what people really want are good stories that are well told. And that, to me, will never change. And if you can do that, if you can tell people something that they don't know in a very entertaining, informative way, there's a market for that.
That's well said, Tom. I don't think that's old school. I think that will always exist. I think good information will always be, at least I hope, of value. I think it will be.
I'm Mark Chapman. Welcome to the Planet Premier League podcast. Each week, Cesc Fabregas, Nader Manua, and myself talk all things Premier League.
As a player, you don't have time to talk.
No.
You don't have time to make a plan. You just need to deal with wave after wave after wave.
We watched Coach Carter, and he said, afterwards, the game's just about doing this for your teammates. And I remember looking around halfway through the film, and half the squad was asleep.
Planet Premier League. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
You're someone who, during the course of your career, has profiled and done stories on, I'll use sort of Sandy Koufax as an example, somebody from who was, you know, a very, very big figure in the 50s and 60s. You also, when you were at Newsday, you covered the Mets, so sort of like the Strawberry Gooden 80s, 90s era. Today, you're covering players, who are at sort of the cusp of the game, like, Mike Trout or, you know, sort of Mookie Betts. So I want to ask you, Tom, given that you have covered generations of baseball players, is the 2020 baseball player as a subject fundamentally different than like the 1980s baseball player? And if so, how are they different as a subject, as someone who would be writing about them, trying to get access to them, et cetera?
I think as a subject, I think in general, there are fewer quote-unquote characters in baseball. I think part of that is they're almost professional players as amateurs. And I say that because if anybody's been around the travel ball circuit, and I'm talking about the elite travel ball circuit, where people travel around the country, play in major league ballparks, are scouted from the time they're, you know, 13, 14, 15 years old, they've kind of been groomed to act like a major leaguer for a much longer time than when I first started covering baseball. I mean, you guys drafted out of high school, they go through really small towns in the minor leagues, and they're not exposed to media. I mean, nobody really knows who they are. I'd like to say that the last person who showed up at spring training as a superstar player who you didn't know who he was Albert Pujols. Now we know about these guys as amateurs, and certainly when they're drafted. And it's like we already know who Ronald Acuña is by the time he puts on a big league uniform. So in some ways, I say there's less characters. It's because they're, I think, more mature in a professional sense than they've ever been. Part of that is social media. But again, I think it's just the coverage of these guys that they're so used to it. That, you know, that's the biggest difference that I see. And all the other thing now is getting time with players. And again, I'm getting back to telling their stories and understanding who they are. You know, when I was covering those Mets in the 80s, you know, we hung out with those guys after games. We played basketball during the day. We played tennis. You know, we knew the families of those guys. That doesn't happen anymore. I mean, part of it is, believe it or not, Richard, part of it is these ballparks that have been built in this last generation are so good that the only time players are at their lockers is when they put their uniform on and off. So there's food rooms, there's Pilates rooms. I mean, you name it. They've sleep rooms. There's so many things to attend to the needs of players that are outside the actual clubhouse proper that the exposure to the media is limited even when the clubhouse is quote-unquote open. So there's less opportunity to get to know these guys and just talk to them as people. I'm not talking about one-on-one interviews and, you know, having a series of questions, but just engaging with them. So they become a little bit more distant that way. So for me, it's access and it's the fact that these guys are really much more polished now than they were a generation ago.
Well, Tom, now I got to know, who'd you play tennis with back in the days of the 80s Mets?
Roger McDowell and Ron Darling were a couple of guys. David Cohn was there, more in basketball than tennis. I'm sure I can tell those stories now, but when they were playing, I don't think they wanted Frank Cashin to know that.
Yeah, that's right. So it's probably not in the contract to play tennis or pick up basketball.
I mean, things were a lot less loose. I mean, a lot more loose back then, Richard. I can remember one time where Dwight Gooden was telling me he was such a good hitter, left-handed. He could have been a switch hitter. I didn't believe it. He goes, I'll show you right now. And we went out to the batting cage, and he had me throw to him in the batting cage. I mean, who would ever allow that now, to have a writer throw BP to a pitcher hitting on the other side of the plate than he normally hits? But we did it.
Oh, my God. Yeah. I mean, could you imagine, like, Strasburg saying, hey, Tom, do me a favor. I need you to pitch batting practice to me right now. Yeah, it's just inconceivable. Wow, what a different time.
Check out our new NBA show, Beyond the Arc, part of the CBS Sports Podcast Network, where you can find me, John Gonzalez, NBA insider Bill Reiter, and Ashley Nicole Moss 5 days a week talking all things NBA. Whether you're looking for insightful discussions, upbeat commentary, breaking news, interviews, or coverage of all the biggest stories in the NBA, our new show is the place to be 5 days a week. Download and follow Beyond the Arc on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and wherever you get your favorite podcasts.
I want to finish up with a couple of quick things. You know, you can't really do a sports media interview anymore without talking about The Last Dance. And you did a piece recently that I thought was just phenomenal. You sort of re-examined Michael Jordan's time with the White Sox. And so I want to ask you a couple of questions about that. What did you learn in doing sort of the writing and reporting of that piece about Jordan as a baseball player that you did not know heading in?
Well, I know I had talked with Terry Francona in the past, his manager in Birmingham, about Jordan. But I was really deeply impressed that that Terry said he arrived with the right attitude. And the whole reasons why he was there, Terry realized, and listen, he's heard the same rumors as everybody else. Hey, he needed to get away from basketball. The conspiracy theorists said he was going to be suspended, whatever. But Terry is a straight shooter. And he let me know, I think he used the word pure. His intention was pure. He wanted to play baseball, period. I love that. I remember seeing Michael in the Arizona Fall League that year. And listen, I knew he hit 202 at Birmingham, did better as the year went on. But I remember looking at him and saying, there's something there with this guy. I mean, this wasn't like Billy Crystal showing up in Yankees spring training to take it at bat as a total lark. You know, it's amazing, I think, as well as Michael did, given the fact that he hadn't played since he was a high school player. I think it was interesting to me that I thought Jordan was on his way to becoming a big league ball player. And I say that not because he'd be an all-star or even an everyday player, but I think there was enough there to think he could be a 25th man, an extra outfielder who maybe can pinch run late in the game, maybe taking a bat here and there, give somebody a day off once a week. I'm not talking about a huge role, but there was enough ability there that Michael Jordan could be a legitimate major league player. Now, Francona thought it would take 3 years. Give him 1,500 at-bats. He had 500 the first year or so. Another 2 years, he was on his way. And I have to believe that Jerry Reinsdorf, if he's got Michael Jordan under contract, and he's doing okay with enough ability, when the rosters expanded in September back in those years, I got to believe that Jordan at least would have been there in 95 if there wasn't a strike, or 96 the next year if he stuck around.
Tom, I'm convinced of this, and you know, I get into a lot of people who sort of push back at me, like, what are you talking about? Look at his stats. Like, I am convinced what Michael Jordan did that year, having not played baseball since whenever, high school or something like that, was incredible. He hit double. I mean, I know, I get double A is not then, is not double A now, and you're not having like the Nate Pearson type of prospect, but the guy basically walked off the street and hit 202 in double A. And put up like decent RBI numbers and stolen base numbers, and didn't embarrass himself in the field. I think he doesn't come close to getting the amount of credit he should for that accomplishment personally.
I could not agree more. And you asked me what I learned and what surprised me. You mentioned some of those numbers, all right? He had 51 RBIs. That's a guy who, let's face it, he had very little power. He was basically a singles hitter, right? To drive in 51 runs in double A without power, what does that tell you? That means in the crunch time, he found a way to get people home. You know, we certainly saw that on the basketball court when the chips were down that he came through. 51 walks and 30 stolen bases. So I actually went back and I looked at the Chicago White Sox minor league system and the major leagues in the last 4 years. Every player in the White Sox system and the majors, how many of those players had 51 RBIs, 51 walks, and 30 steals? And the answer is zero. Nobody did it. You're talking about more than 1,200 player seasons over those 4 years. And nobody had 51 RBIs, 51 walks, and 30 steals. And Michael did that in double A. I mean, listen, if you draft a guy in the first round, pretty much he's not starting in double A, right? He's going to rookie ball, he's going to A ball. This guy hadn't played in 14 years, and he's going to A ball. It is amazing when you look at Michael's numbers. The other thing I noticed, and I hadn't noticed this until I saw The Last Dance those nights, when he was in spring training, you can see he's got a very different swing than what he had in the regular season. In spring training, and actually over that winter, he was working with Walt Riniak, the White Sox hitting coach. And if you knew Walt Riniak, brilliant hitting coach, right? But he was very technical. He had a very idiosyncratic way of teaching hitting. I mean, it's a very advanced way of hitting. And Michael had that Riniak swing in spring training. But to me, that was like taking a kid in grammar school and teaching them calculus. It's too hard for someone who's as raw as Michael Jordan. When he goes to Birmingham, Michael Barnett is the hitting coach there. And he simplified his approach a lot. And if you watch that again, you look at his swing with the Barons and look at his swing with Riniak in spring training, it's totally different. And he hit 276 in August. So he was getting better as the year went on. 252 in the Arizona Fall League with a lot of the top prospects. What an aptitude that guy showed for me to go through basically a swing change, not just coming back and playing, but to change your stroke and have it work. Man, what an athlete.
Tom, do you have Do you recall your reaction to the Sports Illustrated cover? I don't think you. I don't think you were working at SI at the time. If you were, I apologize. But do you remember that cover coming out and what your reaction would have been to that cover, the Baggett Michael cover?
Yeah, I was at SI because, like I said, I remember writing the story in the Arizona Fall League for SI 6 months later, whatever it was, 7 months later. I didn't like it because, first of all, it was 3 weeks in the spring training. I think the Last Dance sort of misrepresented when that story ran. It ran in spring training. So it was total first impression for a guy who hadn't played baseball in 14 years, right? But what I didn't like was the fact that I thought this was the best advertisement Major League Baseball could possibly have. Here's a guy who's probably the most famous athlete in the world, still on top of his game in basketball, and he wants to play baseball. He chose baseball. Baseball didn't choose him. My goodness, you can't have a better endorsement than having Michael Jordan say, "I'm quitting basketball to go play baseball." He should have been welcomed with open arms, and yet baseball establishment, when I talked to Sandy Alderson, he said, make sure you put baseball journalist in this category as well, and I do, is very hidebound traditional, right? And this guy coming in, hadn't quote-unquote paid his dues. He was taking a double-A job away from somebody who's trying to fight his way out of A-ball. All those things you heard in resistance to Michael Jordan, instead of embracing Michael Jordan, putting on a baseball uniform.
Last one for me, Tom. You have worked in this business for a long time. I've told the story many times. When I was 19, I wrote two letters to two sports journalists. One was in Buffalo, who lived like 6 miles away from where I was. One was Tom Verducci, who lived far away and had no business writing me back, but he wrote me a two-page handwritten letter about my stuff, and that's something you, as a young writer, you never forget. And so I know you care about this business greatly, Tom. If you were talking to a 20-year-old or a 19-year-old or a 21-year-old who wanted to go into sports journalism right now, wanted to specifically be in baseball, could you confidently say that person could have a lifelong career covering the sport right now? Or are you, given sort of where we are with the crumbling of newspapers and less resources to journalism as a whole, are you concerned that position, I mean, there'll always be somebody writing about baseball, but can one sustain a career where one can pay their bills doing this for the next 30, 40 years? Where do you stand on that?
I would say yes, and I think you need two things to make that happen at a minimum. You need passion and you need curiosity. It's not just enough to say you want to get into baseball journalism, you want to cover a team, you know, you're a fan of the game, the Mets are your favorite team, the Dodgers are your favorite team. That's not nearly enough. It's a very competitive business. As you sort of alluded there, it's sort of a shrinking business when you think about the number of jobs. But it's a very rewarding business if you love it. And I've always told people, if you're doing something that you love, if you find yourself doing some things when you have free time, not reading when a teacher gives you an assignment, but whatever you're doing when the time is yours, and if you can make that into a vocation, man, you have won. So in a competitive field especially, you better bring passion. And then the other thing I always say is curiosity. You better continue to challenge yourself to learn. To me, Richard, covering baseball is fascinating because I think in the last 5 years, it's changed more than in my first 34 years covering the game. It's unbelievable how much the game, the way it's played, the strategy of the game, certainly the way it's covered, but the changes have come so fast that the only way you keep up with it is to be curious and to realize that whatever you learned before, maybe it doesn't apply now. And it's probably good advice in any business, but I think especially in baseball, you better be curious, continue to learn. And I use this line all the time, which I think is the best advice I could give anybody because I got it from Vin Scully. And like a lot of people, I wondered how come Vin Scully could be so good at such an advanced age doing the same job for so long, and he was still the very best in his last year doing it. I mean, how does that happen? And he actually quoted a line from Laurence Olivier, and he said, it's the humility to prepare and the passion and the confidence to pull it off. So the humility to prepare means that Vince in his last year was preparing for a game like it was his first year, right? He wasn't coasting. He wasn't saying, well, I know baseball already. I know my job. I know how to do this. I don't need to prepare. I can just show up and do the game. Well, no, you can do that, but you can't be the best. So humility to prepare is super important because, you know, let's face it, you go in to take a test in school. If you're not prepared, you're really nervous and you're not going to do well. You did study and you're prepared. You're full of confidence. And that's the other half of it. As he said, the confidence to pull it off. At some point, as many people may believe in you, friends, family, teachers, mentors, whoever, you have to believe in yourself, especially in this business where there are a lot of doors that are going to get closed on you if you're starting out. A lot of times people say no. But if you have the confidence in yourself to pull it off, that's going to get you through all those times people say no for the one time that somebody says yes.
It's always good to end on Vince Scully, Tom. Can't think of a better person there.
The best, absolute best. And I got to add, Vince Scully is one of those rare people who is actually as good or better than you want him to be as a person, right? You look up to somebody and you met, oh, I hope when I meet him, he's really a nice guy.
Yeah, that's great to hear, actually. Tom Verducci is a senior writer and a longtime one at Sports Illustrated, also a broadcaster, both calling games as well as being an analyst for in terms of the studio for MLB Network and Fox Sports. And hopefully when baseball comes back, you'll hear Tom call games. You can certainly still see him on the MLB Network, which has done a really good job, I think, of covering the issues of the game, despite being a league-run network. Their independence has always been pretty impressive to me. Tom Verducci, I can't thank you enough. It's great to catch up with you, and stay safe. And hopefully, we'll be reading you or hearing you calling live baseball very soon. Thanks for joining me today on the Sports Media Podcast.
Well, let's hope so. And Richard, always a pleasure chatting with you. I enjoyed it. Thank you.
All right, back in the studio. My thanks to Tom Verducci for a terrific conversation. The best baseball writer, certainly of my lifetime, and the best baseball writer of his generation, I think for sure. So I appreciate Tom. He's a great colleague, and I really appreciate him coming on the podcast. Previous episodes include Bob Costas. He was our last sports media podcast guest, and he was really, really great in terms of talking about his work with the Concussion Legacy Foundation, what happened in the latter years for him at NBC Sports, his appearance in The Last Dance. He was really good, and I certainly recommend that that interview. Had a couple of sports media kind of gab sessions with Chad Finn of the Boston Globe and John Orand of the Sports Business Daily. So check those out if you want some sort of sports media nerding out. Prior to that, ESPN's Sean McDonough did some stuff on sort of where he thinks broadcasting is and his own experience with Monday Night Football, which becomes pretty relevant, I think, right now. And then just go down the list of interview guests. You had Scott Van Pelt on March 23rd, Dr. Celine Gounder and Grant Wall on March 18th. And if you're into NASCAR, Jamie Little and Shannon Spake in mid-February. Also did something in January with Tim Kawakami and Howard Beck on covering Kobe Bryant. So check out all the episodes in the archives. Please leave us a 5-star review. And that is really basically the way the podcast stays on. So thank you for that. Want to thank Sean Cherry and Patrick Antonetti for all their hard work during COVID-19 putting this podcast together. Thank you for that. Thanks to Chris Corcoran, Spencer Brown, John McDermott, and everybody back at Cadence 13. We will see you soon on the Sports Media Podcast.